You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
Who are you calling a psycho? I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week. And hey, it's a lighter week because of the July 4th holiday, but there's still some big, great comics that are coming out. So why don't we kick it off with a big one? Captain America, number one from Marvel, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Valerio Schiti. We are bringing the focus back to Steve Rogers, specifically to the time period right after he was de-iced before he joined the Avengers. And here we're following him as he figures out what the world is like, what it means to him, and by the end of the issue is going on his first mission to Latveria to encounter Dr. Doom, of all people. There's also some guest stars and the introduction of a new character here. I am curious to hear what you guys thought of this, but I'm mostly curious to ask you when this takes place.
Well, that's the confusing part about this. And I will say, even going through reading the book, I was like, oh, here's when it is. I'm like, wait, no, it's not. Nope. That's not when it is. No, like, it is. There's levels to it, and you have to sort of find your spot. But once you give over to it, yeah. I really like this. It's a nice reset. We've done this a couple times lately with Captain America. Mm-hmm. We had the series that recent, was that JMS that did this Cap series?
Yeah.
And that was like doing this a bit in sort of a different tonality. But this is a little bit, it's an easier tone. This feels like a main continuity type Captain America, despite the fact that it's set in at a moment when he's just coming out of the ice that is somewhat undefined in the larger continuity.
Yeah, this is interesting. When I was kind of learning about this, I was a little skeptical because I was like, all right, another kind of Cap origin, another restart for this. But I think it's interesting enough that I'm not kind of like over it before I read it. I thought the choices were a little different. And it's going to be interesting kind of moving forward. I like this idea of like, okay, if he just became unfrozen and Bucky was dead, instead of him trying to find Bucky and do that whole thing, I think it's an interesting choice to have him kind of go back to the army, go back to his army roots and kind of start from there. And also, what a cool villain to put him up against first. Going after Doom. So, yeah, I feel like for a first issue, this does a good job of getting you excited for what's to come for this. And, yeah, I'm on board. I'm excited to see what happens.
To be clear, I thought this was very good. This is definitely Chip Zdarsky in serious writer mode, very similar to how he was in Daredevil, so you're not getting jokes amid it. But I agree with Pete. The pocket that he's hitting here is really fascinating. I'm definitely paraphrasing, but there's one point where Captain America was like, I was fighting Hitler 2 days ago.
Yeah. Yes.
And
it's really
that
cool.
That whole idea really makes you think of, oh, my God, the dissonance of going from I'm in World War II to suddenly I'm wherever this time period is to just de-iced. I've been fighting with the Avengers. The world's totally different. How do I deal with this? You know, they've dealt with that a little bit in comics, and they certainly dealt with that in Captain America, the Winter Soldier. But this is a very specific way of hitting it really, really hard that I thought was very well done. Also, Valerio Schiti draws a younger Cap that I thought was really well done as well.
The art's great.
Just to be specific, though, about the timeline thing.
Here we go.
No, because I'm legitimately curious about this because they don't necessarily specify it. The whole thing is paralleled against this other character who is on a very similar journey to Steve Rogers. He has asthma. He is kind of a wimp. He really wants to join in the army, but he very specifically says to fight the Taliban. They don't say this, but the implication is that it's, as a lot of people did, signing up for the army after 9/11. So my thought was, oh, we're following this and seeing something that's going to reverberate with Cap in the present in some way. Mm-hmm. Because in the Captain America storyline, we're getting to see Iron Man in the old armor. Right. There's no specific, like, future tech or anything like that. So, sure, it's set in the 60s or wherever. Except, and I should put a blanket spoiler warning for everything that we're going to talk about here on the stack, at the end of the issue, this new character has, in fact, become a Captain America who is there when they topple the statue of Saddam Hussein. And then also shows up and encounters Captain America. So the implication here is that likely this is taking place somewhere in the 2000s, and they've shifted the timeline for Captain America, where he hasn't been unfrozen in the 1960s. He's been unfrozen in the 2000s.
Right.
Which logically, I guess, makes sense if you're shifting the timeline, but is weird. That's all.
Can you work yourself past it, or are we going to have to spend a lot of time on this?
I'm only going to mention it every issue.
Oh, great. We're looking forward to that. How about one of the things that I'm worried... Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
You go.
Well, it's a little bit of a tangent, so if you had something down directly...
Yeah, I just think it is in its... But perhaps purposefully not giving us, you know, we're not getting dated panels at the end here. It feels very modern what Steve Rogers is doing at the end. And then we cut to this other Cap that also feels not that that feels very specific in the time, the toppling of the Saddam Hussein statue. So that flow is really interesting because the Steve Rogers stuff, it makes me think this Captain America that we see is in between. Right.
Yeah.
Wait, what do you mean in between?
He's in between Caps.
When Cap was frozen in World War II and when Cap emerges in this issue. So that's really curious. That's, I think, what Chip's doing here feels like it's very subtly political in perhaps a big way. And that's really cool. And this book is also doing something that I feel like I've asked for a lot. Like, let's not get so craven about the continuity that we can't just tell a cool story.
Yeah, and this book,
I mean that to the world and to sort of myself at the same time.
I'm sorry, I was being specific.
Yes, you are being much more specific in the same way that Saddam is being toppled in this comic. But there's some moments in here with Mr. Fantastic, like, pretending to be a slobby version of himself.
That's what I want. Now you're biting off my salad here. Please stop.
I'm not biting your salad. Hey, Pete, I'm not biting your salad. I'm not using that colloquialism known as biting your salad. Something stop. We all say.
I gave you
a wrong. Hey, stop biting my salad.
That is a very Baltimore, Pennsylvania type.
Exactly, a region we are really establishing as a cultural center. The Baltimore Penn area is always biting their salads.
That's right. I wanted to talk about this, and that makes me very worried about, you know, that's why I voted the way that I did with the Superman or Fantastic Four. Mr. Fantastic's a douchebag, and this clearly, he can't even be bothered for a signature or a take a selfie or whatever. He fakes being somebody he's not just to avoid interactions. Like, this guy is a total douchebag toolbox, and it pulled me out of the...
Just to clarify one thing real quick, on our live show, we were asked if you were going to see Superman or Fantastic Four, and you had to see one or the other, and you had to choose, what would you choose? For different reasons, without getting too in the weeds here, we all chose Superman. Pete just explained his reason, which is Reed Richards is a douchebag.
Yeah, I have a problem with him and the way he's portrayed a lot. He's not a great husband. He's, you know, a horrible friend. It's this guy, he can't even be bothered. You know what I mean? Like,
But if you were him, you'd stretch your jowls a little bit to go.
Yeah, but not to avoid people. I mean, Jesus H.
To meet them?
No, to be able to eat more garbage plates, you know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
Oh, you'd leave space? You leave space in the face?
Yeah, always
leave space for the garbage plates?
Anyway, confusion about the timeline aside, I think this is a really well-done comic that gets Captain America back to basics, and it should be interesting to follow. Why don't we talk?
Yeah, agree, and let me just say real quick, though, Alex, I don't think it's confusion. I think that's a feature, not a bug, that is purposely built into this title that is being maybe purposefully coy in this first issue for us.
Yeah, all will be revealed, Alex.
Gotham City Sirens, Unfit for Orbit, number one from DC Comics, written by Leah Williams, art by Haining. This is a pseudo-sequel to last year's Gotham City Sirens title that also ran weekly. Here we're getting Catwoman, Poison Ivy, and Harley Quinn are investigating a weird space-themed club in Gotham City that may not just be space-themed, as you probably can figure. Yeah, you can figure that out. Anyway, I just love the idea that DC is doing these weekly series, like paired with the the Santa Claus Batman series that they do every Christmas. Give us a summer series with Gotham City. Yeah, give us a summer series with Gotham City Sirens every year that goes weekly. That's great.
Yeah, this is fun. They're teaming up to take down an evil nightclub, and this is just a great kind of pairing of these individuals. I couldn't believe Janet from HR. I mean, she is good for her. I mean, get it, girl. But this is just a great art, fun idea, fun team. Yeah, I can't wait. Cool villain on the last panel reveal. So, yeah, I'm enjoying this.
On the Janet from HR, too.
Yeah.
Just
I was
quick.
Pulling for Killer Croc and Janet from HR, but hey, you know.
So this is like
stay
a
hungry.
This is a little bit of It's a little bit of spoilery for the Poison Ivy series, but like Janet from HR has been. Obviously we have Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn as a big romance in the DC universe. The Janet from HR has been in the Poison Ivy series, sort of the rom-com style. Will they? Won't they?
Right, right.
For the entire series, and it's been pushing in that direction. And this issue sort of is like it's on. Right? Isn't this the first we've really seen?
No. They've hooked up before a couple of times in the Poison Ivy series.
Yes, but in a way where it was like, oh, I can't believe that happened. Oh, what are we doing here? This is like, it's on.
And get in on it.
No, and it happens regularly, and Harley is fine with it, and sometimes she likes to watch, and they're in a polyamorous relationship, which...
Yes.
It's just the difference between, like, subtextually, that's what's happening in Poison Ivy, versus here, textually.
Sexually. And quite sexually. But I just thought that was interesting the point of what you're saying, Alex, I really love this as a summer event, and the way that it combines all these characters that have their own books and then come together in this book that is, again, not really owing a lot to the individual continuities of these books, but just like, let's have a fun story with slightly different art that has that summer vibe that we're sometimes looking for. Very cool. But to have a sort of statement like the relationship that's happening here, and we get it all sort of, it's very much a sexual moment between Janet and Poison Ivy, and Harley's like, sick, let me know how it goes. I'm like, we have never seen this particular scene play out. So that just was, from a advancing a relationship point of view, this was a pretty big issue, I thought.
Now, let me ask you, as someone who's still shipping Croc and Janet, do you think, you know, maybe Janet will circle back around for Croc? Because the two of them together were dynamic.
Let me go the complete opposite way. I've been pulling for Janet and Poison Ivy from the jump, even above Poison Ivy and Harley.
Whoa.
So like, and not to say, I mean, it feels like their relationship is such that it is open where they can do what they want. But I've loved the chemistry between Poison Ivy and Janet. So
do you
like,
think maybe
I'm
this is a trouble in paradise situation?
No, I think quite the opposite.
Okay.
But I'm just saying I've loved the build of their relationship in the Poison Ivy series. And to see it sort of pay off here in that way, I was like, I love this.
Sisterhood, a Hyde Street story, number one from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Mytol Zchut, art by Layla Lays. This is the team that was on the Devour one-shot a year ago, probably a little less than that. Mm-hmm. This is a five-issue miniseries, and it focuses on two girls who go to college, they're best friends.
Man.
One of them, a spoiler, but this is the solicits, dies in a hazing accident, and the other one gets involved in some mystical, supernatural goings-on Hyde Street that twist things by the end of the issue. What did you think about this spinoff?
This is scary and sad as fuck, man. I mean, first off, they survived this unbelievable car accident, and then, this is the kind of fate. I was just heartbroken. But I'm hoping that, we're going to get some ghost revenge or something, you know what I mean, moving forward. So It's exciting, but this is scary as fuck.
Pretty solid guess that's going to happen, Pete, so you should be pleasantly surprised by the next four issues.
Sweet.
I think I have two takes on this. I like this story in this issue. It was horrifyingly tragic. So much happens in this first issue that I'm curious if the book will continue at the same pace, because I do think we're going to get some extremely nasty revenge, though there has to be some surprising moves happening in the narrative, because it's just like there's one ghost, there's one hero, and there's one villain. So I don't know what the next four issues will be. Secondarily, I feel like this imprint, having Hyde Street be a home for just sort of standalone horror stories that like connect lightly to this imprint and some of the characters on Hyde Street, is awesome.
Yeah, it is.
I think this is a great move for Ghost Machine to become a home for books like this. I was very excited by this, because we've seen the one shots that have come out under Ghost Machine that have been really cool, like Devour specifically. But this is really, it's a sort of a big step forward, I feel like.
I also agree that they are pumping out these spooky stories like some sort of
ghost machine?
Oh, that's what I was looking for. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, a machine that makes ghosts.
Yes, exactly.
I got really scared and I was like, oh, it's just a machine.
Yeah. Nope, just a machine. X-Men Hellfire Vigil number one from Marvel, written by, ready? Jackson Lansing, Colin Kelly, Jed McKay, Stephanie Phillips, Jeffrey Thorne, Gail Simone, Evel Ewing, Alex Pachtadel, Jason Liu, and Murua Ayodele. Art by Javier Garon, Netho Diaz, Sean Parsons, Roy Mercado, Marcus Toe, Luciano Vecchio, Frederica Manson, Declan Shelby, Sarah Pacelli, and Luciano Vecchio. This is a follow-up to the Hellfire Gala issues that were very popular with fans and everybody, basically. Now we're following a year on from the end of Krakoa, and everybody, well, mostly everybody is gathering in New York to pay tribute to it, to dance, to party, to give speeches one last time. And true to form for this sort of thing, we also get some big revelation drops throughout here in terms of what's coming up in the X-Men world. I don't remember this exactly happening the same way with the Hellfire Gala specials. This is very much the different teams on X-Men jumping in for connected one or two page stories, some that take place at the Hellfire Vigil, some out. So that's the basis for this. Justin, you seem pretty psyched.
Yeah, Justin, you hit it, buddy.
I loved this. I feel like we did a State of X podcast like a month ago that I think went through all the X books and was like, here's what we like, here's what's working, here's what I think is struggling a bit. And I think this comic is sort of their State of X. They're taking all the stuff that I think is working and elevating it and bringing these characters together to reconnect and set up and honor what's come before and set up some stuff to pivot into going forward. I thought this was great. It touched on all or most of the characters that I feel like are really relevant and have had the best emotional arcs in the individual books, and really brought them the focus to focus here. Just to highlight a couple, it was nice to see Colossus, though he's gigantic. why is he so big? He's really dealing with the fact that he was tank. He's like, I like this tank mask. It's like, okay, cool. We all knew. We get to see Kitty Pryde catching up with Iceman in a nice way. Some flowers for White Queen. It all comes to a head with Dazzler in a way that I thought was dramatic and gave us that level of fear that the X-Men are dealing with now. Something that has been relevant for so long with the X-Men is sort of their core situation where they're constantly under fire from goons in masks. I felt like putting that front and center here was really good. And then we're still getting some like big revelations about Storm happening here that were super exciting, and Cyclops and Phoenix having a nice moment. Like, I just thought this was a great book top to bottom.
Oh man, I'm glad you're having fun with it. I do, you know, that big Central Park spread scene was fun, but I was like, did they really get the permits for this? I mean, come on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that's the most fun way to read it. Where they get the tent?
Yeah, exactly. And
who's
no
lighting
way.
The candles? Who's says Pete, clean a up fan after... of comic books.
Who's going to clean up all this mess? I mean, you know, you got to be back to Central Park the next day. You know what I mean?
Sorry, I didn't know you were the around. Deputy mayor of the X-Men universe, Pete. Yeah. Doing all the worries.
You know, this is very much like a softball issue or a baseball issue where you're just kind of checking in with people, seeing how they're doing. They're kind of being like, oh, my God, who's here? This is exciting. Oh, I haven't seen you in so long. And then there's like Scott Summers, who's being the curmudgeon, and Phoenix visits him and she's like, you should get out more. I was like, cool. Is anything going to happen? No, we're just checking in, which is good. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you just need a book where it's just like, let's just check in about what stuff is happening.
You know
can
you find some fun here? What's going to bring you back? What, you want to just keep hating the X-Men?
No, I don't.
An iconic thing?
No, I don't. I would like to have something happen that I could get behind and be like, yes, this is exciting.
50 things happen in this issue. To show okay. you, there's a couple of them you liked.
Yeah, I mean, it was great to see Storm. You know what I mean? I've been loving her series. I feel like they're doing a great job with that. Yeah, it is good. And hopefully will continue to be good. But yeah, I felt like this was a kind of fun visit with everybody. You know, it was just like a nice kind of visit.
I felt like this was a little bit all over the place. There were some things that I really liked in here. I think all three of us seem to agree. The Storm pages, in my opinion, were the best. They were beautiful to look at, and just what Storm was dealing with here. We're not spoiling it, but it means big things for her future, and I think it told a very concrete story about Storm in a series of short pages, which was very impressive. Some of the other things... I don't know, it was hard to get a hold on what the Hellfire Vigil was, and maybe the chaos was sort of the point, but, like, there's a Dazzler concert, and every once in a while somebody would stand up and make a speech, and then there's some people just kind of hanging out there, and it was sort of a party, but also a funeral.
Vigil,
and,
yeah, so...
I don't know, so... Yeah.
It was a... Let me say, well, let me just explain what you're... It was a little weird, because they, I believe what the idea was... They activated the gates once again, the Krakoan gates, via a pin that was teleported to each mutant who was invited, because they didn't want to invite like Apocalypse and Mr. Sinister. And
smart.
Because the gates were activated, there was a Dazzler concert in Chicago and then a party in New York, and people were going between the two venues. I was like, guys, make it easier
yeah,
than that.
Yeah, I know. Like,
that's
why
not a
Dazzler...
great way to plan a party.
Yeah, you can't do one place, but...
Yeah, they over when the Dazzler concert, it should have been, like, pre-recorded.
Yeah, I was like, there's no need to be like, this is taking place in two cities. Like, who is this for?
Yeah, and it seems like Dazzler wasn't invited because she had to do a concert.
Yeah, I don't know. That was my issue with it, is the previous Hellfire Gala things always had the central organizing principle of, we're at the Hellfire Gala, there's a specific mission that the mutants want to do now, and there's other people off doing their separate things that either, like, tie into that mission or contrast with it and are working against it. This was very much a jam. This was like, let's have two pages of what's going on with the Ankeny X-Men characters. Let's have two pages of what's going on with Storm, etc. And so that's why some of them worked, some of them didn't, and that's okay. But, like, it felt discombobulated to
me. I think there were so many people working on it that it kind of had to be a jam. You know what I mean? To kind of get everybody...
It's a different sort of thing that they were going for.
Yeah.
And I get that.
I didn't mind that. I enjoyed that. I like that as part
Justin
of this.
Loves
it feels
jam.
Classic. Yes, I like a jam session.
A character jam, if you will. You
and let me say, I've not enjoyed what's been happening with 3K as the villains in the main X-Men book. But I like what they did here. I think this was a statement point for 3K. And this, I wish, was the introduction of them as opposed to the sort of... Mm-hmm. bit of a waffling we've had of the introduction of 3K as waffles. The villains in the X-Men book. So this gave me actually hope for 3K as a good foil compared, like in line with having the other threats, one, the ONE group that's after them and the other threats that Cyclops is so worried about in this issue, feel like the odds are stacked against the X-Men in a way that I think they're at their best.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
This is an announcement to all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all. With a struggling economy and the cost of living on the rise, Endurance is now offering an affordable, low-cost vehicle coverage plan to the general public. As of today, you could be one of millions of drivers that now may qualify to have your vehicle protected under this coverage and have all future covered auto repairs paid directly to the repair shop for you. You pick your plan, you pick your deductible, you even pick the repair shop. Roadside service, towing, and rental coverage is included. To all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire, get your vehicle protected now and save your wallet from costly vehicle repairs. For your free 5-minute quote and to see if you qualify, visit endurancewarranty.com. Endurancewarranty.com.
Why don't we move on and talk about Absolute Green Lantern number 4 from DC Comics, written by Al Ewing, art by Janoi Lindsay. In this issue, we are continuing the fight between Hal Jordan and Joe Mullen, but back in the past, we're getting to see just how Joe got her powers and how things started to go either right or wrong, depending on who you ask. Pete, you love this one, so take it away.
First off, sick cover, bro. I mean, come on, look at this thing. I mean, this
you
is
love
just
Green Lantern.
Dude, setting a great tone for what's inside. And, I mean, you've got some epic panels in here. Just some really just, whoo, that the part where that, like, floating symbol went crashing to the surface. I mean, that was just bananas. There was also some kind of weird panels where they were drinking beers but didn't look as right. But, like, the splash panel stuff was just really unbelievable and epic. I loved the kind of, like, this anomaly kind of bit that was going on. And, yeah, I just, I love, this is just so enjoyable. I feel like the art sets just such a cool tone. This is an interesting story that isn't kind of normal Green Lantern in a unique way. So I'm having a blast with this.
I feel like we've talked about this in the past. This is the most Stephen King coded comic that's come out in years. This issue especially, to have this the sort of the revelations of what's actually happening
here. So like a
here.
Shawshank Redemption type of thing? Or what are you talking? Which Stephen King?
No.
Green Mile?
Yeah, Green Mile a little bit, but definitely the other sort of
Mr. Whiskers?
Nope. I mean, we could all sit here name it. You could say almost any now and it'd be like, yep, that's a Stephen King book. Yeah, probably. Thinner. Now, the more mystical, like larger, like the Langoliers and things like that, where it's the mist. Isn't that
Needful
one?
Needful Things. Is that what you're actually thinking of?
I don't know. I actually haven't read a lot of Stephen King.
Jesus.
And this way, I'm still right, I think.
Okay.
By the way, Langoliers was wrong, though, but go ahead.
Okay, great. But the way that the story unfolds, where it's like characters in a place, something's wrong, and they find out sort of like halfway through the story, like, oh, here's what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of formula here, it feels like. And that's what we get in this issue, where they're really cracking it open.
Yeah, I really like this, and I like this more every issue. I know people were iffy on it at the beginning, but I continue to really like Janoi Lindsay's art throughout. It is very manga influenced that plays, particularly in the fights between Joe and Hal. Without ruining it too much, I think one of the things that's really neat about this issue in particular is how it really flips who we think might be the good guy and who we think might be the bad guy, and starts playing with that in a really big way and a really fascinating way. It's changed the Green Lantern mythology completely while using the same terminology. I'm having a really good time reading this one.
Agree. Yeah.
Gehenna, Naked Aggression, number one from Image Comics, written by Patrick Kinlan, art by Maurizio Rosenzweig. This is about a lady who just wants revenge and she's going to get it.
Yeah, I mean, the hard thing about this is Naked Aggression is, you know, being naked and trying to be aggressive, you know, it can backfire real quick, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting combination. But the title aside, this is really badass. I love the art. It has this kind of gritty old school feel to it, which I very much enjoy. You immediately kind of know what's going on with the character and stuff, and this revenge kick that she's out for. So this is a blast. And love the pace of this. Tons of action. I cannot wait for the next issue. This is cool.
Yeah, I would classify this as like a female Punisher drawn in the style of the Spirit.
Ooh, interesting.
Which is cool. Like, it is. And the book does, like, it breaks the issue up into different parts where they keep reintroducing the title over and over again, which I thought was actually... It actually matches the style in a good way, but it's big, big sound effects, big bombastic but classic action. A character that I was like, this is ready made for Pete LePage, the icon of the comic book industry. So all the way down to in the end, we get like a black and white sort of preview for the next issue. Like, I was like, this is hitting. Like, this is finding a tone in the first issue that I think works really well for this particular story.
Agreed.
The Immortal Thor, number 25 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Jan Basaldúa, Justin Greenwood, and Pasquale Ferry. This is the final issue of The Immortal Thor because Thor is dead.
Yeah!
And he spends the rest of the issue fighting his way through the afterlife and then dying again and then rebooting things for next month's The Mortal Thor, number one.
Spoilers. Yeah, so when I first kind of picked this up, I was like, oh, wait, cool cover. And then I was like, wait a second, we're really spoiling things. But Thor's killed right away here, so, like, we get past that early. Yeah, and then we kind of get this interesting take where, you know, we're talking about the Donald Blake kind of thing a little bit. And then, and then it kind of happens in an interesting way. So even though we kind of knew that what was going down, it still happened in a satisfying way. Sometimes when it's kind of like, oh, and then they give it to you, you're a little like, wait, what? But I felt like they did it the perfect amount. So, yeah, amazing art, cool idea. I'm on board, man. Let's do it. Get mortal, bro. Come on down to our world a little bit.
Yeah.
Make sense of this shit. Come on, bro.
Well, and like, we're dealing with the sort of Donald Blakeness of it all, I think, in general here. And the transition from the immortal Thor to what's coming next is really, it goes through the lens of Donald Blake. Something that has fallen out of favor, I think, in the Thor mythology in the last, what, 10 years? Mm-hmm. And I like that. Like, that's the Clark Kent Superman switch. And I think that's something we could... That I like his part of Thor, and or at least I've not to say I don't like what's come in the last 10 years, but like I'm ready to get back to that classic look, and it feels like maybe we're touching on a version of that going forward.
Also, it was interesting this whole kind of like evil hammer kind of mirror thing, which was kind of unique. So I thought,
yeah,
that was cool.
I think this is what Al Ewing has been doing all along, is doing stories about stories. And here we have him walking through several iterations of Thor, from ending his own iteration with the immortal Thor to going back to Donny Cates' era with the evil Donald Blake, to jumping all the way back to, I know we're talking about Donald Blake, but the last part here, and we'll see, I thought was really intriguing because I believe Pasquale Ferry is the artist going forward on the title
and
after
I
this.
And I like him.
Like him a lot. This seems like, just on the surface, a mix between JMS's Thor, where nobody had their memory and Thor had to reactivate everybody, and Thunderstrike. So taking those two ideas and jamming them together, if that's what he's doing, I think is fun and interesting. And he certainly has shown with all new Venom that he does a really good job of just like bringing a title back to basics. So really curious to see what happens.
The idea of being nostalgic for Thunderstrike is interesting, Alex.
Mm-hmm. You can make it work. Make it work.
Nice.
Why not?
What a thing to ask for.
Alex, Justice League versus Bucky's paw curls. That was the last finger, I think.
And another finger curls on Alex's 15-fingered monkey paw.
Oh, man. That's got a lot of fingers.
Define an era for Captain America that is not the original era. Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong 2, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Brian Buccellato, art by Christian Duce. In this issue, the Justice League is transported, I don't know why I played that word, to the
crazy Monsterverse there,
Earth. Encountered Kong, who is fighting a giant.
They're at a transfest in the middle of Utah, and they are cutting loose.
Yep. They see him fighting a giant killer croc, and they are on the trail of Lex Luthor and the Legion of Doom. Some other things happen in this issue. Pete, you're our Godzilla fan. What'd you think?
I do love Godzilla, and the problem here is Godzilla is not in this comic at all.
Have you seen any Godzilla movies? Because he's also not in those.
How dare you, sir?
He's not.
How dare you?
He's the Jaws of his own thing. He doesn't talk.
Hey.
He doesn't talk.
Well, that's if you guys let me get through my review. I cover these types of things. So
you're covering this?
Yeah, I am going to be covering this in my review. Oh, if you could just hold on, it would be great.
Let me get out my notepad. I want to take a little notes on what Pete is covering today in his review.
So we get this killer croc that is the size of Godzilla. And what was disappointing was we know killer croc can talk. And I was excited to kind of see or hear from Crocmore because he is filling in for Godzilla a little bit here.
Hear from Croc.
And I would have liked to if Croc got to say some things or do some things, because this is a cool idea of killer croc being brought to the size of Kong to fight him. And it was just like this back mat. It was just like happening in the background. Like this was so much about puny superheroes.
I'm sorry, did you read this book? Because I think you're just describing the cover right now. Thank you for doing that.
And that's been a longstanding wish from Alex Albin to be the page. Yeah. But let me just get the stuff. I can get the headline from your coverage down. It's like Big Croc, no talk.
Yeah, exactly. Big Croc,
and what
no
would
talk.
He have said? I love Janet from HR. Or?
Oh, have you guys seen Janet from HR? Like she's not returning my phone calls.
The fight is very front and center. That's why I don't know what you're talking about.
It's too quick. Like, come on, man. Well, this is an epic battle.
First of all, they established in the previous issue what goes on when Killer Croc becomes giant and monstrous. This is continuing that. The thing that's crazy to me about this book
is it's too much about the superheroes and not enough about the giant monsters. I agree, Alex.
First one, and we talked about this in the first one, they were like, well, I guess Guy Gardner is dead. All right, move on. Now Kong is Green Lantern. Let's go. This series so far, issue one ended with them shooting Amanda Waller. And we talked about this. We're like, well, maybe she shot at the gun. She'll recover. It starts with like, no, she's dead.
Yeah.
She's 100% dead.
Literally, first page, I think they talk about how dead she is for a while.
Right. And then several pages later, Killer Croc loses all of his monster energy that he's been amped up with. And he dies. And the Justice League stares at his dead body for like two panels. And they're like, Killer Croc's dead. Well, anyway, moving on with the way that they're just casually killing people off in these books is wild to me.
Yeah. And then Supergirl gets backhanded by Kong. It's like, what's happening, man?
Oh, wait. This is another thing that I forgot to mention in the first issue. Why do they keep establishing the time period when it's the same time period? Every couple of pages or so, they're like 4 years after G-Day. And I'm like, what? Are you going to jump forward or backward in time at some point?
We get that here in this issue,
yes,
too.
Yes, in this issue, they keep reestablishing it. I don't understand why.
Well, I think surely it must pay off eventually, but it is crazy that it is not paying off
yet.
Because
I
do think everything is in the same time period. They just keep reminding us how many years after
it's like if every time we reviewed a comic, we were like, it's 2025. Now Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong 2, number 2. Next up, Black Hammer, Spiral City, number 7. And just so you know, it's 2025.
Yes. Well, maybe people need that object permanence.
Exactly.
The thing with this comic and all of these like Godzilla comics that the DC's doing,
comics are coming out.
Definitely. Yeah. But they go very deep into like specifics about the lives of these characters in a way where it does feel sort of strange. You can see this as being just a big knockdown, drag out fight, and they're like, no, we're dealing with concern over the Flash's concussion. We're dealing with Lex and Superman fighting in the Hollow Earth 4 years after G-Day. And it's like, okay. So, like, I got to applaud the specificity, I guess is what I'm saying.
I do like the big stuff going on here. That's fun. I do like Lex and Superman fighting in Hollow Earth, and then the huge evil monkeys from the new Empire showing up. That's fun. So I enjoy reading this book, but there's a bunch of just weird things that keep throwing me. Yeah. Anyway, Ultimate Wolverine number 7 from Marvel, written by Chris Condon, art by Alessandro Capuccio. Last issue, Wolverine was broken of his conditioning, and now he is catching up with the X-Men, or at least what's left of them, and trying to figure out what that means for him now. And at the same time, the Russian Confederacy, if that's what they're called, but Magic, Omega Red, and Colossus are terrorizing their scientists.
Very nasty.
And finding out some terrible information that means bad things for our heroes.
Colossus, Justin, continuing to be a huge villain. I like this book a lot. This has been a slow burn of a title, I feel like. This is issue 7, and it's been like really moving through this idea. Logan was a villain, Winter Soldier, just killing force for 5.5 issues. And now he's back to being a hero with the rest of his team. I really like where we are with this. This feels very post-apocalyptic in a way that I think the other Ultimate books aren't even touching. And that's nice. That's a nice area for this book to explore, I think. And I like the emotionality here. I feel like we can really ride with Wolverine now because we got to experience all the nastiness that came before. Something I think that is gestured to with a lot of Wolverine books, but in this book, we really felt it throughout.
Well, unlike JT Sizzle, I'm not a fair weather Wolverine fan. I always ride with Wolverine. I don't
always?
Sometimes ride with Wolverine. I'm always riding Wolverine.
I'm going to hold you. You're always riding Wolverine? Are you just like behind him on the motorcycle?
Sidecar.
You're riding in a sidecar.
Yeah. Cute. Yeah.
He's like, hey, bub, you want anything from the gas station or no?
Yes. I would love a Mountain Dew.
Jerkies.
Don't forget to wear your helmet, bub.
Yeah, so all the motorcycle jargon aside, I agree with JC Sizz.
Jargon.
It's tough because it's like we've seen this before. You know what I mean? Wolverine is like, as soon as he's done being brainwashed, he kind of goes through this thing. He's like, oh, I can't believe all the horrible things that I've done. It's like, yeah, bro. Like, maybe after the 8th time, it's got to be a little less, right? But no, okay, bro. Have your moment. Cool, bro. You know what I mean? It's got to be tough when you're made to kill people you don't want to kill. So,
but my point is, I would argue it is different here because he really experienced it more. Then lately, I feel like we get the shorthand of like Wolverine comes out of a berserker rage. He's like, "Oh no, did I pop my claws?" And everyone's like, "Yeah, you do. You pop your claws at the drop of a fucking hat, guy."
Yeah, it's kind of your thing.
Of course you did.
Yeah, it's kind of your thing. But the hardest thing for me about this book is I liked Quiet Wolverine, so this was kind of like, okay, he was really kind of monologuing here a little bit.
What is your deal? Wolverine talks too much. Killer Croc doesn't talk enough. Make a decision.
Yeah, anyways, the hardest thing for me is these kind of evil versions of characters that I like Magic and Colossus and stuff. So it's hard to see them on the wrong side of things here. So I'm hoping this is going to kind of work out a little bit because right now it's just you know, people are supposed to be friends or enemies, and it's just heartbreaking, you know.
I don't think it will happen, but we'll see. Black Hammer, Spiral City, number 7 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Teddy Christensen. This is the final issue this miniseries as things come to a head in Spiral City. We've got a bunch of balls in the air, including a mayoral election. Inspector and Sector is trying to track down a killer, and he thinks he's solved it, except he hasn't really at all. And meanwhile, we're checking in with the rest of our characters who are all sort of bummed out when finally the heroes return at the end.
Yeah, this is a very touching ending. I liked it. I feel like this was such a great... Jeff Romero is such a pro and did such a great job of landing the ship. I feel like it got a little weird in middle parts, but really love this touching ending. And I just want Inspector and Sector to have its own TV show because I feel like the name would be such a cool theme song or something. But yeah, this was an absolute blast, and love the art, love the storytelling, and just a great ending for this. Very kind of touching.
I really enjoy this. I feel like these stories are always just excellent, with surprising takes on the tropes that we expect to see from this. Like, Inspector and Sector is meant to be like a great detective in the Question or even Batman way, but Inspector and Sector almost does nothing throughout this entire title except for monologuing about how he's really on the case, and he just witnesses. And he's like, after all, I'm just a fool. The last line of the comic. That was cool.
I disagree.
Yeah. The rest of it was like, it was emotional. It was villains still having solid feelings in them, heroes messing up or being down to earth characters. Really great, sort of upsetting the apple cart style storytelling.
Wolverines and Deadpools, number one from Marvel, written by Cody Ziegler, art by Roger Antonio. This is actually the end of Cody Ziegler's Deadpool run, and for it, we have two Deadpools. Per the title, we're bringing in the two Wolverines, and they're all teaming up to face a new baddie. Pete, this should be hitting all the sweet spots for you, did it?
You ride with Wolverine, I believe.
Yeah, always, always.
Ride on.
Always be riding with Wolverine.
Do you have a little Pete saddle that you ride on the back of Wolverine? Like, that is right on his sacrum?
It's a sidecar. We've already established it. It's
but
a sidecar.
Hold on. When there's two Wolverines, who rides where?
You go laps, you know what I mean? Like,
go laps.
Yeah, like
you're lapping it.
X-23 will sit on my lap, or I'll sit on X-23's lap, you know?
Not like they drive ahead a couple of blocks and you chase after them. When you catch up, one of them gets off and you get in.
No, that's way too complicated. Anyways, this is fun.
I would tend to agree.
This is fun. cool villain reveal, cool team ups, fun banter, great art and action. I'm excited to read more. But yeah, I thought this was, they delivered on the title in a fun way.
What I found interesting about this is like the way that the Deadpool fourth wall violation has evolved.
Right.
In this, it's not just a like an awareness of being in a comic, but it's an awareness of who's writing the comic, the entire like fame of Deadpool and all of that. There's a line here sort of in the early, maybe a third of the way through the book, but it says, gotta go, but Dad says hi, and then he hasn't seen you since the Duggan run.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's
dude, come
funny.
On. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't think he's reading his own comics. I mean, the guy likes his stuff, you know?
But that's a funny spin on the Deadpool story, and there's so much continuity in this book specifically. This is much more a Deadpool-heavy book than a Wolverine book, I would argue. But I do like the sort of families that they've established here, and this and the villains that are revealed later I also thought were cool.
Yeah.
This is a little chatty for me over the course of the book.
Well, it's good.
Real packed with dialogue. At the expense of action, but there is a really nice exchange towards the end of the book where Deadpool talks to Wolverine about being a dad that I thought was a really good conversation.
Yeah.
So hopefully more of that going forward. Batgirl number 9 from DC Comics, written by Tate Bromble, Woo-hoo. Art by Takeshi Miyazawa. Batgirl has finally tracked down Bronze Tiger, but that's just the beginning of the revelations that her dead, quote-unquote, mother Lady Ooh. Shiva has left for her, leading to a big shocker by the end of this issue.
Yeah.
This title is great.
I agree. First off, very cool cover. And there's a place called Whitefish, Montana. I'm hungry. I want to go there.
I've been there. I worked on a show there once.
Oh, really? It's a real place?
Yeah, it is a real place.
Does it have amazing whitefish?
I don't think specifically that's their thing in the way that you're talking, but there are a lot of breweries there, And there was also that was the home of a real series of hate crimes once, like 5 years
ago. Oh, no. Oh, man. Just when I was
going to
go visit.
Do you want to go? We'll see if we can do a show there.
I was
going
to go, but then, oh, man. But yeah, love the use of detective skills here. You know, JT Sisson loves to get in characters' heads. You know what I mean? And there's this.
I live in those heads.
Yeah, you do. And so there's this cool moment where Batgirl's kind of reading people and being like, oh, they're avoiding. They're avoiding the question. And then she kind of shares that she's also doing it. I thought it was just such a great. Kind of small but huge moment. And I love this book. I love everyone on the team and all the characters that we're dealing with and the fact that we're learning all this information about Batgirl and love the reveal. This is just a blast and I'm enjoying it.
I really like this book is being very confidently laid out. From an arc point of view, I like the way we're moving through it. And the setup of the three swords coming for Batgirl is awesome. And they're weaving that in a sort of headline way and then getting back into the main story. And then, boom, at the end, we get the first pop. It's just very smartly paced.
Yeah.
All New Venom number 8 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Carlos Gomez. The All New Venom is fighting Flash Thompson at the beginning here, and as we can see on the cover, captured by Dr. Octopus by the end. And in the middle, a lot of other stuff is going on, particularly Rick Jones, who is also a sleeper agent, is being terrorized by Doc Ock. We've been enjoying this. We talked to Jordan D. White, the editor, on our live show just last week pretty extensively about it. But what did you guys think about this issue?
Oh, well, you took the Jordan D. White thing away from me. That was about all I was going to say. It was kind of funny to see MJ in this cocoon submarine thing. That was kind of a weird panel that made me laugh.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah, I know you do. Great art. Tons of things going on. Interested in reading more.
I talked about this with Jordan in my previous takes on this comic.
And
the tone
when
of this
called them later after the interview.
Yep, this tone really lands with me, where it's a little irreverent. It's like going hard on the story with Venom, Mary Jane as Venom, and this sort of weird death connection that her and the symbiote have, while making fun of its own. Continuity level, I think, as well. This issue is really focused on Doc Ock in a way that I didn't see coming, but it's still fun. Doc Ock gets to really quote some shit, shouts to Rick Jones the Defenders t-shirt that he just keeps wearing. I'm here for this book all the time.
Arcana Royale, number 3 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Cullen Bunn, art by A.C. Zamudio. This is about a woman who has joined a demonic poker game. Well, it's not specifically a poker game, but it is a card game.
It's like a tarot card poker style game, I think.
Yes. Ooh. And the stakes are basically the fate of the world. She has been taken to a new fabulous location to play the biggest game of the year, and everything becomes even more deadly by the end. I really like this book. I think the stakes are really fascinating. I wish I had a better sense of the game, because I don't know how she knows how to play it, other than she just kind of does, but it's cool. We're getting some good beasties in here, some intrigue. There's some good twists by the end, so I am enjoying it regardless.
Yeah, same. I really like just the premise, I think, is really cool. And yeah, we don't know the intricacies of the gameplay, but the stakes are clear throughout. And we see in such a great comic book form, the way the consequences come as the stakes get raised. And, you know, that's what we want out of something like this. I don't need to know every detail as long as I get to see what's happening and why it's happening. And this book is fun in that way.
Yeah, cool cover, amazing art. The art reminds me a little bit of Lock and Key with the tension of panels. Yeah, I love this idea of the card game being more than a card game. And, you know.
Like when you play Uno.
Yeah. That's a great call.
Drop a reverse on that, and then, like, there's a fucking hurricane somewhere?
Whoa. Too soon, man. There's too many hurricanes going on in the country. But I do think that They do such a great job of setting things up to kind of really want you the next issue to be out already, you know?
Godzilla vs. Thor, number one from Marvel, written by Jason Aaron, art by Aaron Cooter. This is basically Jason Aaron doing his greatest hits through a Godzilla story, yes. Which is wild. It starts off with the hand making Godzilla into the hand of the fist of the beast. Is that what it is?
Yes, from his Punisher run.
Yeah,
from
nice shout out run. To the Punisher. You know what I mean?
Then fighting Thor and then powering up Godzilla with All Black, the Necrostorid, to make him into Godzilla, the God Butcher. And it gets even wilder from there. Pete, this had to be hitting all of your buttons.
Yeah, this was a lot of button hitting and a lot of smashing, which was great. A lot of kind of like, hey, remember that? That was pretty cool. But
see, it's interesting that this book is pressing the buttons that Pete likes. And I feel like I'm always pressing other buttons on Pete.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you have different buttons?
I do. I wish you would start hitting the right ones. But I do think that, like, the just kind of fun with Godzilla came through here, right? Because it was like, oh, what if Godzilla was the beast for the hand, you know? And then it was like, oh, yeah, what if it was Godzilla the God Butcher? So it was kind of fun to see these upgrades, you know, as we went along, and just kind of over the top fun, and it was action packed. So you got Aaron on Aaron action here, so they're having a blast.
I agree. I love the art here. This has been my favorite of the Godzilla titles, I think, that have come out, because it does go so hard and so far away from just the idea like big lizard wreck stuff. Like, this goes deep and distant from just a simple idea, and that's where I want it to be.
Birds of Prey, number 23 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Sammy Basri. The birds are under attack by a mysterious team of enemies. They've already taken out Barda. Now it looks like they've taken out Barbara Gordon, except, of course, they haven't. And in this issue, the birds begin to fight back. Every issue of this is great and fun and twisty. The art is really good. The layouts are good. I just really enjoy this title.
The most consistent comic book on the stands continues to be this book. And I don't know what else to say, but it's excellent always. Each character is drawn both in the art and in the writing in such a specific way that feels... It looks easy, but it's actually very hard to balance all of these characters at the same time.
Yeah, Kelly Thompson is killing the game in this book. It's really impressive. Also, like, glorious cover here. This is just badass. But I'm enjoying all these little things that are happening. They're building up to these bigger things. And I'm just so impressed with the use of characters and the way that we kind of get to feel excited with each and every issue. And you got to get up really early in the morning if you're going to pull one over on Barbara Gordon, all right? Because she's got plans on plans. And, I love the emotional roller coaster, the relief in this issue. This is just so cool and so exciting. And it continues to be one hell of a run.
Do you feel like you do better when you get up earlier? Like, you feel like you can get one over on other people?
It depends. You got to go to bed earlier, too, because that's the key. You can't just get up earlier. You know what I mean? You got to also go to bed.
That's what I wish we talked about more. Like, you got to go to bed pretty early in the evening, like before the party's over, if you're really going to do this.
Well, why don't we move on to the next one? X-Men, number 19 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Netho Diaz. You know, we skipped the past couple of issues of this book.
And what brought us back?
Well, so
Alex,
here's the thing. This is picking up on the miniseries Heir of Apocalypse, which Cypher Doug Ramsey into this character called Revelation.
He's known as Revelation. He's always been Revelation.
I put this in the stack because I was like, you guys are going to make fun of me. I'm going to get pissed off because Cypher is Revelation, and that'll be, you know, like, fun thing to talk about. Here's the thing, though. I'm not going to get pissed off because despite the way Heir of Apocalypse ended, I actually think the way that they're treating this is really interesting in this issue.
This was maybe my favorite issue of this X-Men run.
It's happening. Yeah, like, all right, if you I guys agree. Are gonna, let me go then, if you're going to be ridiculous. This should not be called an X-Men title. This should be called Three Randos, because what the fuck is happening here?
And do you think that would sell as well?
I would hope so. You know what I mean? Because
Marvel presents Three Randos.
Three Randos.
That's, guys, that's us. That's our podcast. Got a surprise.
Oops, really stepped into that one there. Great art. That's the only nice thing I have to say.
I love this because it's specific. Each character I understand. They have a great
you
relationship,
do.
The three of them. Yes.
You understand, Cypher?
I do. I really like the Doug and his partner relationship is awesome. It's one of the most interesting relationships that has been in the current iteration of the X-Men mm-hmm. run. Like, it feels real. It feels like, oh, they fight in a way, but they love each other in another way. The fact that you've got Warlock there doing his thing, like, and Doug just being down to earth about this weird thing that happened. Because I think, and Alex, back me up on this, the Revelation thing felt dumb because it was like, why are we powering this character up? What does this mean? Now he's this Apocalypse figure that is annoying, probably. And in this comic, they undercut all of that and made him who he is with a very interesting and exciting power set. Like, I feel like he could become a central character in the X-Men. This feels like a Legion-level character now mm-hmm. that could really run something here. And if he becomes a big figure in this series, like, that's excellent, I think.
Well, and the thing that really won me over here is exactly what you're saying, undercutting him shaving his head. They start that immediately with him being like, yeah, I grew my hair back. I don't know. Him trying to be a regular guy, knowing he has this power, is trying to do the right thing, but also wrestling with the idea of, okay, Apocalypse told me I need to follow up on his ethos of survival of the fittest. What does that actually mean? How do I do that? It could go horribly wrong in the next couple of issues. That's fine. But just on the basis of this issue, the way they write Doug trying to wrap his brain around this and trying to do it in an ethical way and being forced into situations where his ethics are potentially going to get compromised, that's an interesting place to put a character.
Well, and the idea of, like, you must, like, make survival of the fittest happen is a dumb idea. That's not an idea. You can't do that. The fact that he is, like, owning that and being like, I don't know what he means by that. I guess I'll just go about my business. Oh, these guys are going to kill us. And he's like, I won't kill you. And then his wife is like, I'll kill them right now. He's like, babe, knock it off. It's good. It's very good stuff.
Yeah, very surprised. Resurrection Man, Quantum Karma, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Ram V, art by Anand R.K. and Jackson Butch Gweiss. We, in this issue, are following Resurrection Man as he finds out his greatest enemy may not be the otherworldly cannibal who is coming after him, but potentially himself, which I thought was a very shocking twist, but a smart twist that really follows from what they've done previously in this title.
It's worth it for the art alone. I mean, some of these panels in here are just absolutely amazing. The kind of purple veins running through that, like, one-page layout was so cool. This should be taught in class. I mean, this is unbelievably impressive art.
I don't want to be controversial. Ram V's getting a lot of cred and press for New Gods, and it's great. I think this is the better book. I am enjoying this book more. I like the story more. I think the art is fantastic. I don't know. I think just as many people should be reading this as New Gods.
Yeah. And last but not least, The Amazing Spider-Man, number 7 from Marvel, written by Joe Kelly, art by John Romita Jr. In this issue, Spider-Man and Black Cat come face-to-face with Hellgate, a new villain who seems to have no qualms about murdering people to get Spider-Man's attention. What do you guys think about this one?
Well, Justin, you got to be heartbroken because Hellgate, it just is the third wheel crashing the Black Cat Spider-Man moment that was about to happen. But man, crazy to see Black Cat with two Uzis. What is this, the 80s? Come on!
Yeah, Uzi, a long forgotten weapon that I think we've all been. It does remind me of like Mark Bagley drawing the Punisher in Amazing Spider-Man as well. It's maybe a sick throwback there, but I think this is great. Also, this is it's such a weird thing. Joe Kelly's run is all about like getting back to basics with a lot of regular Peter Parker stuff while also pushing him into the craziest situations. And that's what we get here with this Hellgate character that he and Black Cat get to be like, what is the deal with this guy? While they're absorbed into this nonsense situation. Like, it's a good formula that I think we haven't seen in Amazing Spider-Man in a while.
This is striking me the exact same way as the 8 deaths of Spider-Man, where I was like, Spider-Man with mystical stuff, that never works for me, and then it 100% did. Here, having Spider-Man go up against essentially a Doomsday-type character who looks like Ares, on the surface, I'm like, I don't know if that's going to work. That seems like an odd mismatch, but it's great because like a lot of those other tales where Spider-Man goes up against the Juggernaut or the Hulk or some other unstoppable force, same thing here. It really pushes him. It pushes him to show his heroism. You know, in the narration, he's like, I don't have time to be funny right now. I can't be funny. I got to keep going. And that you're like, oh shit, this is serious. Spider-Man can't make jokes right now. So this is good. I don't know what Hellgate's deal is, but Joe Kelly is really knocking it out of the park.
Also, you should mention, Ramada Jr. here is just, it's great.
Yeah, always good. And also always good is you for checking out the Stack Podcast. That is it for this time. But if you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comics, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Tell us which croc you want to date. If you're up for dating a croc, he's available, clearly.
Ah, oh, poor croc, you know?
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.